I pretty quickly reached the conclusion that the impact of this would be as great or greater than the impact of the birth of HTTP and HTML or the birth of the web, right? That this was of the same magnitude, if not larger, because this essentially meant that money would become a native data type on the internet.
Hello, welcome to episode 50 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. This episode also marks 3 years since I started this podcast. Back in 2013, when I was first getting into Bitcoin, Jeremy Allaire's interest in the space was a big validation of Bitcoin for me. So I was pretty excited when Brian Cohen introduced me to Jeremy to arrange this interview. In today's podcast, you'll hear Jeremy talk about his early days exploring the internet, building companies based on internet content tools, his 2013 decision to create a payment company built on Bitcoin, and finally, Jeremy talks about his brand new open source project, Center. Here we go.
Hello.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks so much for coming on the Bitcoin Game.
My pleasure.
I'd love to hear what your childhood was like and what influences or preferences you had that might be related to your success.
I initially grew up in inner city Philadelphia, and my parents had me going to a progressive school, and I had a Montessori education until I was in fifth grade. And I actually, when I look back at things that have impacted my, you know, call it risk-taking or entrepreneurship or sort of ways of thinking about different things, Montessori education certainly, I think, had an impact. It encouraged me to, you know, think independently, to follow my own interests, to sort of non-conventional, you know, form of learning. So I think that was important. And at a relatively young age, I sort of tried out different forms of entrepreneurship. So I later moved to a small town in rural Minnesota, and sort of my teenage years growing up were there. And but I was, you know, a huge baseball card collector. And I, when I was pretty young, I think I was 14 years old, 13 or 14 years old, I started my first company, which I called Allaire Sports Cards, which was, you know, basically a dealer, a trader and a dealer in baseball cards. And it was, my parents had given, one of my grandparents had died, and they had left a little bit of money, not a lot of money. And my parents had sort of said, okay, we're going to put this in a mutual fund because that was the state of the art for how you save money. And, you know, and when you go to college, that'll help or whatever. And I convinced them to let me take all the money, and invest in baseball cards. And, this was like 1987. And there was actually a bubble in baseball cards back then.
Wow.
yeah. And it was interesting. And my work a little bit with my brother on it. And we, were trying to apply, statistical methods to predict player performance and different things. And, but it was a hustle kind of business, and it was fun. So that was like my first kind of entrepreneurship, if you want to call it that. But, I would say I always was interested in pursuing things that I, you know, were interesting to me. And you know, I think also early, you know, I was lucky because my father was a tinkerer and, himself took a lot of risks in terms of his own career. He tried a lot of different things, and that helped me, I think, see like, you can try a lot of things. You can follow your bliss. You can really pursue things that you're passionate about. And that's, that can be fulfilling, and it doesn't have to be going to work for a big company or something like that. So that was helpful. And, but I also was lucky because we got an Apple IIc computer in 1983 and, you know, got to be part of the birth of the PC generation and hacked on computers and learned very simple forms of programming and had a modem and got into online communities and stuff back in the 80s. And was very conversant with that, you know, early on. And then in college, you know, was very lucky as well because my dorm mate, who had his job, his like work study job at college working for the IT department. And my college was one of the very first colleges to have internet access in 1989, 1990. And so I got lucky and got a, you know, T1 to my dorm room in like 1990. And that was a really huge privilege and became deeply inspired about the internet back then. And that certainly helped me out as the 90s came into play.
Wow. So I remember T1 sounded really big. What, how much data is T1?
I think a T1 is like 1.5 megabits per second, which, you know, like a T1 is basically like the whole campus had a T1.
Right.
And that was what an entire company back in the, you know, when companies first started getting connections to the internet, like an entire company would have a T1. You know, that's like 1,000 times faster than a dial up modem at the time.
Right. So what kind of stuff were you doing in these early days?
My undergraduate work was focused on what I would call kind of international political economy. So I was interested in political science and economics, but also very specifically kind of the interplay between kind of politics and economic systems and how the world worked. And I was very interested in the sort of comparative model, sort of market capitalism versus, you know, sort of the classic socialism versus at the time what was sort of the middle way, which was the Asian tigers and what was the experiments that were being conducted in privatization in East Asia. And so I was very interested in all that and very interested in international affairs. And, you know, but I got access to the internet and I had a Mac at that point. I had a Mac laptop. I don't remember exactly what it was called, but it was a Mac laptop. And so I, you know, I was just completely enamored with the internet then. And back then it was basically, you know, FTP servers and email lists and Usenet news groups. And I was finding every corner of the internet I could find. I became obsessed with, you know, kind of learning how it all worked. What is an IP packet and what is it, you know, what are the building blocks of how internet technology works? And I explored a lot of different things. I, you know, was very passionate about how a commercial internet could emerge. And at the time it was sort of government run and an academic run, and a senator, Al Gore, had a committee in DC that was a sort of committee that was talking about how to commercialize this infrastructure. And at the time, the infrastructure was called the NREN, the National Research and Education Network. That was the internet in the United States. And that was different than DARPANET. NREN was sort of a little bit more public than the way the military used it. And I actually wrote one of my big papers was sort of a proposal for a national information infrastructure that was built on open IP connectivity and commercialization of ISPs. And I sent it to the committee because I was just, it was sort of an interesting thing to do. But the other thing that was really interesting for me was I was just completely fascinated by the disruption that the internet represented to how information exchange could happen and the free flow of information. And I would consider myself libertarian socialist. And I realize some people think that's a contradiction, but I think it's a pretty deep form of thinking, which was sort of how do you build, you know, kind of fair governance models that can help people, but also that represent huge amounts of human freedom. And the internet looked to me like a really interesting platform where you could really change how information flowed and how media and communications worked. And again, this is pre-web. This is before there were anything like web browsers. But what blew my mind was I was studying, you know, the Balkan wars that were happening and also the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I was able to communicate with individuals that were, quote unquote, behind the Iron Curtain. And some of these were, you know, journalists that were publishing just incredible accounts of things. And some of them were, you know, people in their apartment buildings that were witnessing tanks rolling down their street and protests and all kinds of stuff that, you know, CNN couldn't see it. Right. There were no satellite trucks with cameras. This was all closed off. But the internet had already reached through the Iron Curtain because of academic and scientific institutions. And I was communicating with these people and it just blew my mind. Like, this is incredible. And so I really got passionate about decentralized networks and open protocols and what this meant for the future of society and how it would work. And I became a very early member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and, you know, communicated with Mitch Kapoor, who was one of the founders, and just became fascinated with all of the ideology and the intersection of ideology and commercialization that happened in the early internet. But the big ideas to me were, hey, here's this open distributed network and it's built on software and it's not centralized. No one controls it. And I really thought back then that it would change the world. And I think a lot of other people did too. I'm not alone in that. But I got very excited. And then when I graduated college in 1993, you know, I had a philosophy degree and a political science degree and studied economics, and I started temping. I didn't come from any significant means. And so sort of, okay, I'll get a job temping and figure out what I do. But I just kept coming back to the internet. And basically when the first web browser, the first graphical web browser came out in September of 1993, it was from the National Center for Supercomputing Applications in Illinois. People spread the word very quickly within like a week of that becoming available. And I downloaded that, and that was a mind-blowing experience. And it was very clear, like, okay, there's a graphical interface now for the internet. And this graphical interface can be used to, you know, create global online services. It could be used to create transactional systems. It could be used to create, you know, change how software is built and deployed. Got really excited about the possibilities. And that really led me into my first serious, you know, grown up entrepreneurial activity, but it was sort of shortly after getting out of college.
Fascinating. You had your vision of what might happen with the internet. I mean, how does the reality of the internet today compare to what you envisioned?
It's so much bigger than I ever envisioned. This tends to be the case with technical disruption is, you know, you can see the contours of it. And you can have a lot of ideas about, oh, wow, that's going to really change this or that. But the reality of the change is just so hard to actually see. And you know, the thing about technologies is they compound on each other. You know, one technical disruption synthesizes with another technical disruption. And then there's these compounding and nonlinear changes. And it's just impossible to see those. And we're experiencing those now. The velocity with which these compounding technical changes is happening is just astounding. I actually do remember, though, it would have been 1992. There was an article written by a writer predicting, you know, where this would all go, where technology would all go. I might have even been in Wired magazine, which had just came out. It envisioned, you know, AI and mobile and cloud, and, you know, it didn't use those words, obviously. But and I remember saying to my roommate, who was pretty techie as well, like, you know, this is exciting. This can happen. And, you know, he was deeply skeptical. There's no way, never, you know. You're never going to be able to have like a device that's connected to all information and that you can talk to, and it just goes and does things on your behalf. And, you know, but, you know, here we are 25 years later. So things take a long time. I think what's happened is just way beyond any expectation I could have had, for sure.
So your first grown-up jump into entrepreneurship was at the Allaire Corporation?
That's right. Yep. So back in the 1994, I had sort of declared myself an internet consultant, which meant that people paid me to educate them about the internet. But I also became a web developer and started building websites. And I really wanted to build, websites that were interactive, that were more like interactive online services. And my view was that all this sort of stuff that was happening on AOL, you could just do that through a web browser. And I started trying to do what's called, you know, CGI programming using Perl, which was the language people used to do that kind of stuff. And it was horrendous. And my brother had just taught himself C++ and was also really interested in the internet. And he said, well, let's, you know, there's a better way to do this. And he was a software programmer and a software engineer, and I had a lot of very specific ideas on how to use the web for interactive software. And he built a little engine, which became known as Cold Fusion. And I was sort of like the product manager and initial customer, which was essentially the first commercial web application server. So was, there were techniques for connecting a database and server-side logic to a web page, but there weren't any commercial products. And we thought, hey, you know, everyone's going to want to do this. Every business in the world's going to want to do this. And every person, you know, anyone with an idea and $1,000 should be able to build a global online service where if you have a web server, anyone with a web browser could interact with you. And that's going to be really significant. So that led to the development of that product. And it was a developer product. It was, you know, for people who wanted to build database applications and interactive applications on the web. And, you know, that grew really fast. You know, there was a product that was built and released on the internet, and thousands of people just started buying it. And it was, it used a form of, we invented a programming language, which was with a syntax that was similar to HTML. So it used tags, like a tag, like you see in an XML file, to express programming constructs. So it was a language that someone who had not done programming before could learn really quickly. If they could learn HTML, they could learn how to program. And that really, our belief was that, you know, the web is going to create the possibility for so many more people to build software than had ever been possible before. And there needed to be new kinds of programming languages to facilitate that, that were easier to write and easier to read. And so we built that, and that grew, you know, really fast. And we ended up taking venture capital, and we ended up building a whole family of products, like much more sophisticated kind of enterprise infrastructure for doing, you know, sophisticated kind of transactional infrastructure applications, as well as the most popular HTML development tool called HomeSite, which millions of people used. And we grew to, we grew that from 1995 to 2000 to, you know, pretty good size, $120 million revenue business, very profitable, global, millions of customers. And then we merged that company into a bigger internet software company called Macromedia. And I became the chief technology officer there. And that was a really exciting agenda. So Macromedia had kind of done some of the most popular tools for designing the web, basically graphical design tools, web design tools like Dreamweaver, interactive design tools like Flash. And we had sort of the programming tools. And so we kind of merged that all together. And then we worked on kind of reinventing Flash. This was in 2001. From being an animation tool into actually something you could build really rich applications in. And so that was a really exciting project. And, you know, Flash became the most popular piece of software on the internet for a while. 98% of computers had it. So just an enormous number of people. And the big thing I got really excited about there during that time was we put video technology into Flash. And up until 2002, which is when that happened, like if you wanted to watch video on the internet, it was really slow. It was like a postage stamp kind of viewing experience. It was, you go in a web browser and be, which plugin do you have? Which codec do you have? It was just a huge pain in the butt. It was terrible. But we put video in Flash, and I got very excited about that and sort of felt like, hey, you know, within a year or two, every computer connected to the internet is going to have a consistent way to play back video. And it's going to make video as ubiquitous as publishing text on the web. And there's an opportunity to build a new kind of publishing platform around that. And that actually, you know, I left Macromedia and then not too long after started Brightcove, my next company. And that was a online video platform company, sort of software as a service video with everything you need to run sophisticated video experiences. And that business, it's a public company. I took that company public in 2012, and it's got, you know, huge numbers of big media companies, big brands, lots of people. If you watch video on the internet and it's not on YouTube, a lot of that is powered through Brightcove. And that was a really fun project. And is, you know, that's still a significant independent company with, you know, customers all around the world.
Are you able to talk about what made you decide to leave Macromedia and start Brightcove?
Yeah. You know, so I was the chief technology officer of Macromedia, but I was basically kind of commuting from Boston, and my family is in Boston, and it's hard to do the East Coast, West Coast commute and to try and be, you know, kind of looking after and driving, you know, different forms of strategy on with product teams that aren't in the same location is hard. But the bigger thing was, I had actually taken a little sabbatical, in 2002 and just wanted to explore like what was really interesting to me. And I went really deep into video and interactive video. And I was looking at what we had built in terms of infrastructure with Flash. And I just was convinced like this is huge. And so when I got back from my sabbatical, I asked the CEO to kind of create a stealth little startup team internally and built a kind of video publishing app that you could use through a browser, that you could video blog, and you could publish simple videos with templates. And we kind of got it to like an alpha stage, but it wasn't a business that at the time the Macromedia team really wanted to like scale out and launch. It was, I wanted it to be a consumer business. They weren't interested or didn't know how to build consumer businesses. And they had some other really good bets at the time. And so I thought, you know, I'll take a little time off and I want to keep exploring this. And so I left and was an entrepreneur in residence at a venture capital firm in Cambridge and helped look at a lot of different spaces, but just kept coming back to this problem area and wanted to build a company and build a company around that.
Is it time to start talking about how you first heard about Bitcoin?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So I became interested in Bitcoin and the broader technical innovation of kind of crypto and blockchains about 5 years ago. So I was CEO of a public company, Brightcove. And you know, I'm always interested in different things that are happening. And you know, I think picked up through a blog post an article about it and was just immediately extremely curious. And you know, that curiosity was picked. And so I just kept reading what I could. And I think for me, you know, my longstanding interests in sort of how does open infrastructure and open protocols change the way the internet works and political and economic issues and financial issues. I was very interested in how the financial, you know, meltdown happened and very interested in how different forms of economic systems worked. So that was sort of these kind of personal interests combined with my kind of internet DNA and platform interests. This was just a really interesting synthesis of all that. And so I became pretty obsessed and, you know, I talk about sort of different aha moments in my career that are around different technologies. And I remember, like I mentioned earlier, when I downloaded NCSA Mosaic in September of 1993 and saw a graphical interface of the internet, that was like, oh my God, this is going to change everything. Another moment like that was when I saw, you know, kind of seamless video playback in the Flash Player in March of 2002 and said, oh my God, there's going to be ubiquitous video everywhere. And that was controversial at the time. Right. And so, you know, in late 2012, you know, when I downloaded my first, you know, Bitcoin wallet and synchronized the blockchain and, you know, started experimenting with a Bitcoin transactions, that was like downloading NCSA Mosaic. It was just like, oh my God, this is, you know, this is going to change everything. But to me, and so that led me to talk to, you know, Sean, who is co-founder of Circle, and we had collaborated on and off for 15 years on lots of different things. But I had always enjoyed working with him. He's the most talented software person I know. And he had also kind of come into an interest in this area independently. And we both just started exploring that interest together. And I pretty quickly reached a conclusion that the impact of this would be as great or greater than the impact of the birth of HTTP and HTML or the birth of the web, right? That this was of the same magnitude, if not larger, because this essentially meant that money would become a native data type on the internet and that the storage, transmission, and exchange of value of all types would just become a commodity-free service on the internet, the same way that the storage and transmission of data and content and information has become a commodity service on the internet. And that got me really excited. And Sean and I both felt like, you know, there's going to be some very significant global consumer internet companies that get built around this. And we felt like we wanted to work on that. And that led us to Found Circle.
You're a Bitcoiner, but you have the iconic Bitcoin keychain? Support this podcast and own the Bitcoin keychain you've probably seen hundreds of times on sites like CoinDesk, Bitcoin Magazine, Ars Technica, Vice, Popular Mechanics, Engadget, and many, many more. Just go to btckeychain.com. That's btckeychain.com. Was there any, you know, experimenting and playing around, something between the first discovery and Circle?
So the thinking for us was, you know, it was not so much like, okay, you know, what's Bitcoin? How do we use Bitcoin? Because, you know, you have to take a really long view on all this, and you can't just assume, okay, there's this technology that's here right now. But what's interesting is sort of extrapolate out, like, what could happen? How could this technology evolve? What would that mean? So sort of look out a little bit further and sort of imagine how it could evolve, and then build a strategy around that. And, you know, similarly, like, you know, the first web browser was a piece of crap. You couldn't do anything with it. You couldn't securely transact on the internet until, like, you know, 1997, 1998. But browsers had been around for years, but that didn't stop people from starting companies in 1994 and trying to kind of build out the web, even though there was so much that was needed before it was actually kind of commercially ready. And we felt very much the same about Bitcoin. There were a lot of ideas that were being bantered maybe the wrong word, but being discussed. You know, all the thinking about smart contracts, the ability to kind of have code that's deployed on blockchains and have kind of programmable money, extensibility, you know, how could we extend the blockchain so that other forms of data could be stored on it, or you could have other tokens. So these are all ideas that existed in 2012 and in early 2013. And so those are all things we got really excited about. And we sort of said, okay, if that stuff happens, then it's really possible to imagine essentially what we think of today as kind of consumer finance, retail finance, or retail banking, or whatever you want to have, think of that as that is going to be replaced by delightful free consumer internet utilities that allow people to store and send and receive money the same way they can store, send, and receive content and messages and text and other forms of data. And we wanted to build that. So that was the first thing we wanted to build is that kind of experience. And, but we wanted to do it, in a way which fused the existing financial system with this new infrastructure. So we weren't, and we've never been Bitcoin maximalists, both in terms of ideology, economic ideology, or even technically. We've been very vocal from very early on that there's a lot of room for innovation in this space, and it's not like one white paper and one piece of code is going to be the final intellectual property that this all moves forward on. We were very open to that and very, frankly, concerned with the stagnation that was taking place in development of Bitcoin, that we needed some of these ideas to be pursued. Now, of course, that's very clear to everyone, right? There's an enormous proliferation of ideas in blockchain technology. There are meaningful competing blockchains that have very significant innovation that goes way beyond what Bitcoin originally was designed to do. And, you know, there's going to be more, right? Just like, you know, we're not all using NCSA Mosaic any more than we're using Netscape Navigator or Internet Explorer. The technology protocols and standards evolve, and the people who execute the software around it evolves. So I think we're still in an early stage here, even with what feels like really big platforms out there now. But we wanted to we wanted to kind of build towards a vision of kind of consumer payments as a commodity service on the internet, in the same way that email and web browsing and search and other forms of information exchange are commodity services. And that's what we set out to build, but we wanted to do it also in a way which was legal and compliant, and that would allow people to use traditional money, but using this technology behind the scenes. And that's sort of what CirclePay is and what we built up over a period of time to get out there.
You guys were actually exchanging dollars for Bitcoins, and I guess maybe in other countries too. Was that always meant to be kind of temporary, or can you tell me kind of how the transitions went with that?
Yeah, so the way CirclePay works is there's obviously like this consumer experience, and then there's the ability to connect existing fiat money systems, bank accounts, credit card networks, other things in multiple currencies to Circle and to send and receive payments. And the core use case for CirclePay that we wanted to solve was, how do you make, you know, instant person-to-person payments work in a way that's free, and also a way that works across currencies, and finally in a way which works using open settlement rails, so that it's not just the legacy financial system that you're using, that you can actually transmit money over blockchains, and you could seamlessly move between a dollar and a Korean won, or a dollar and an Indian rupee, or a dollar in my wallet into a dollar in your wallet, and settle all of that using a blockchain network. And Bitcoin was obviously the first and only blockchain network that worked. That was the one that we built on in the first instance with CirclePay. We built that so that it would work seamlessly, so that you could essentially transmit dollars, euros, pounds to any Bitcoin address. We didn't think that the average consumer was interested in, using a new currency. Like, you know, my mom and dad, or the people, my coworkers, like, they're not like, I want to switch from dollars because I don't believe the dollar is going to be around anymore. And, you know, there are certainly people who are looking at that as a store of value and as a safe haven and so on, but that's not mainstream consumer payments. We wanted to enable mainstream consumer payments to run on this infrastructure. So I could take dollars and transmit them to a Bitcoin address, and maybe the wallet on the other end would receive it as Bitcoin, but actually might use it as euro or use it as dollars or whatever their choice was. But we could use an open network to move value in a secure, fast, cheap way, instead of using the old rails that are centralized and have a toll and a tax associated with them. So that's what we built. We certainly had a lot of people who essentially used that as a way to buy and sell Bitcoin.
Yeah, I did.
And it was a really good deal because, you know, we want payments to work instantly and for free. Like, we don't believe that there should be a fee to move or store money. And so that carried through to how the Bitcoin piece worked, which is like, you could instantly have Bitcoin, and you could instantly transmit value using Bitcoin, and you could just use a debit card and there'd be no fees. And that was pretty cool. And people definitely really liked that. But there are really two different behaviors. So, you know, kind of free social payments is a very specific behavior, and it's becoming a more mainstream behavior. And we think in the West in particular, it's about to become a really giant, giant mainstream behavior like it has in China. And we want to be one of the leading apps to do that. I think the, you know, buying and selling Bitcoin is more like an investment behavior. I'm interested in this as an investment, and I want to buy and sell it as an investment. We had hoped that the merchant side of Bitcoin would have taken off, that there would be like mainstream use cases for payments, but it just didn't take off. Like, there's just nothing out there. And so that use case wasn't very compelling. And if anything, the only real merchant use cases were dark web kind of stuff. And that obviously wasn't something we could support legally or financially. And so the investment use case is just a really different use case. And we're very interested in that. It's just a different user experience, a different flow, a different product than someone who's just trying to make free social payments. So we sort of turned off the direct buying, selling Bitcoin piece last December. And I know that definitely disappointed some people, but that's not the end of it for us. We've made some public statements about this. So a couple of things have happened. So one is, in order to build Circle Pay, in order to enable us to transmit fiat money over the Bitcoin network, we had to build out a trading operation, a treasury and trading operation that could manage the liquidity across fiat and crypto. And we did a lot of that in an automated way across exchanges, but we also, as the flows on our system grew, we also built kind of over-the-counter trading capabilities. And, you know, that's really grown. So now, you know, Circle Trading, which is a line of business, a major line of business for us, is we're, you know, either number one or number two largest crypto asset trading organization in the world. In August, we directly traded over $2 billion of crypto assets using our own balance sheet. So we're a major market maker and a major liquidity provider to the whole ecosystem. And, you know, if you want to trade Bitcoin or Ether or Litecoin or Ripple or Bitcoin Cash or Ethereum Classic or any number of coins, you can trade those directly with us. Go to circletrading.com and sign up. But it's for, you know, larger institutions. So I think it's, you know, kind of minimum kind of $100,000 trades, and a lot of the trades are in the millions of dollar trades. So that's a major thing, and we're growing that, you know, right now. But we want to connect the dots, you know, between that kind of infrastructure we've created around trading and liquidating and storing crypto assets and the kind of mainstream consumer experiences that we're able to deliver, and the kind of regulatory position we have and the risk and compliance operations that we have. And so we've shared a little bit publicly, but we're working on a new product that's focused on how to make, you know, investing in crypto a mainstream experience.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we're very excited about, you know, crypto assets more broadly, not just the core digital currencies, but the broader proliferation of crypto assets. And, you know, we're very bullish about it. And, you know, we want to create ways for, you know, grandma to invest in digital assets. So that's something that we're working on.
Wow. I would have expressed a huge, I don't know, something when I heard the amount of volume you guys were doing, except for I'd heard it before, which was, I guess, kind of what led to this interview. Just, and I know I've often, you know, seen people like think you've completely abandoned the space rather than we're, you know, one of the major market makers. What percentage of I don't know if you know this offhand, but the entire trading volume would be a Circle?
You know, it's hard to know because, you know, there's obviously the volume that you see traded on exchanges through like CoinMarketCap and things like that. And some of that's levered volume, so you have to kind of discount that as well. But there's just a huge amount of volume that happens in OTC. So if you're, you know, say a hedge fund or, you know, a wealthy individual, and you want to make a multi-million dollar bet, or you want to, you know, take a large position, it's just not efficient to do that on exchanges right now. And so these kind of larger desks like Circle and Cumberland and Genesis are just easier ways to do that. So there's a lot of volume there, and there's similar types of kind of traders in Asia as well. So there's a lot of volume that's out there that just is not measured in the same way. But yeah.
And it's funny, go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I've never really thought about how the volume is measured. Like, I was like, oh, well, you're looking at the blockchain, but I guess you're not tracking every movement of a coin and calling that a sale. It could be just moving within a wallet. So I guess that's just ignored when people calculate these values.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, so for us, you know, like there's a major focus on how do we build these delightful consumer payment experiences and scale those and make moving and storing money just a free service on the internet. And that's a big, big focus. And that's all grounded in crypto and blockchain tech behind the scenes. And then there's this, you know, kind of trading and investing side, which we want to really turn into a mainstream phenomenon, mainstream for institutions. So, you know, institutional investors, but also mainstream for, you know, the average person that would like to put $5,000 or $10,000 or $50,000 to work investing in digital assets. And right now, there aren't really super streamlined, easy ways to do that. So that's definitely a space that we're excited about. And then the other is, and this is something that, you know, last December we started to talk a little bit about, which is, you know, we talked publicly about the fact that we were redesigning the way that the infrastructure behind Circle works around new capabilities that things like Ethereum made possible. And we had a project that we had codenamed Spark that we started to talk about. That was right at the same time that we stopped people being able to buy and sell Bitcoin. And that is now, has been introduced as the Center project. And, Center, and you can, read about it at center.io, is a major effort from Circle to, again, make consumer payments work the way that the web and email and other infrastructure on the internet works, which is, instant, global, cheap, secure, and decentralized. So Center is essentially taking several years of intellectual property that sits behind Circle Pay, and it's being redesigned as a node of software that runs as smart contracts and on the Ethereum virtual machine, but also is designed to be able to interoperate with the Bitcoin network and SegWit-enabled payment channels, and creates a way to do, fiat money, so cryptographic tokens for dollars, euros, pounds, everything else, directly transacted between digital wallets on the internet. And it's really aimed at, why can't I use Circle to pay someone who uses Venmo, to pay someone who uses Alipay in China, to pay someone who uses Paytm in India, or to pay a merchant that's got a web server? Why can't they set up a digital wallet so I can just pay them? So it's taking that infrastructure and intellectual property, and we're spinning it out into a nonprofit foundation, the Center Foundation, and that will house the open source project and development, and also facilitate nodes that want to run on the Center network. And we're really excited about it. I mean, it's a major project to make consumer payments work using crypto and blockchain tech. And make those work the same way we can have different email clients and different web browsers and web servers and make those all work together. So that's something obviously we've just published and launched the project, and we're really excited about that too. And so that's really behind the scenes. What there's an early version of the technology that is running behind Circle Pay, and as the Center software gets fully released, that'll just be the infrastructure that we use to run Circle Pay as well. And the vision is that any digital wallet, any mainstream digital wallet, any financial institution, any merchant can just implement this software and be able to move money, cheaply, securely, globally, in a decentralized way.
Okay, Jeremy, you just blew my mind. That sounds, like a huge, ambitious project, but it also, with you behind it and everything you've been doing, it's like, wow. The website again?
Center, CENTRE.io. And really all that's there right now is just the paper about it. And there's a lot of detail in the paper about the project and about the software. And we've got a number of people working on it. We're going to be scaling that up. And like I said, it's being spun out as a separate entity. And our view is, this is only interesting, this whole area of sort of open global consumer payments, it's only interesting if there's open standards for how it works. And we all benefit from the global network effects that come from that. There's no benefit to Circle just trying to do this ourselves. It really needs to be open intellectual property that anyone can build on and use. And so that's really a major impetus behind, rolling it out this way.
What's the timeline of you think this being adopted and working? And
like I said, there's sort of early versions of this that are working behind the scenes that run Circle Pay today, and it's technology that we've developed over several years. The redesign and re-implementation on on the EVM is ongoing, and things like SegWit and Lightning and other stuff on in a mature deployed state in Bitcoin is sort of just emerging, but we're hopeful that this sort of new versions of this are going to be available next year, and that it's not just Circle implementing it, but lots and lots of other interesting, global players in digital wallets and, merchants themselves, just like, in the early days of the web, if I was a business, Nike or whatever, Nike used to have to sell its shoes through other stores and other distribution channels, but then the web came along and they could set up Nike.com and they could have customers directly access their their inventory and buy from them. And, you know, businesses could have direct relationships to consumers. And that was a really new thing. And they could do that freely and cheaply using HTTP and HTML and distributed decentralized networks. So we think the same thing's going to happen with money. And, you know, if I'm a business and I have a website and I, you know, want to collect digital payments from people around the world, you know, I want to be able to, just like I can set up a web server, I want to be able to set up a digital wallet that can collect payments no matter what digital wallet you use, no matter what currency you use, and can settle that transaction instantly, cheaply, securely. And that's what, that's sort of what Center is designed to enable. So we're excited about it.
If I had a consumer wallet that did this, I mean, is everything running on my computer, or is there some backend stuff helping me out besides blockchains?
Yeah. I mean, you know, most of this, you know, the nodes, the Center nodes, would typically be run by, you know, like a wallet company that is a financial intermediary of some sort, like Venmo is an example, say in the US, or Alipay in China, or what have you. Technically, of course, you know, some third party developer could implement it, and build a web user interface on top of it. It's just, they just need to make sure that, you know, if they're, you know, storing crypto tokens for dollars or euros and facilitating payments, you know, that might be a regulated activity. So they have to make sure, you know, that they're following all the laws. And so we don't get around, you know, the need to do things legally. But, you know, a business that wants to accept payments directly, you know, they can do that today. You can, you know, as a business, you can accept payments directly. It's a node of software that people would run, whether it's a wallet company or a merchant acquirer or a business that wants to run it themselves. But developers would be free to tinker with it and build on it, and third parties and the like. I mean, it's open source.
You already have a way you envision like how the security would work for a consumer using a wallet like this, or is that way down the line?
It's no different than other crypto tokens, right? So if it's a crypto token that represents a dollar, it's secured, you know, it's an ERC-20 token. So it's secured using public private keys, and the same way that you need to protect your private keys applies to these kinds of transactions as well.
I guess that's where I'm kind of going. Have you found any solutions to help grandma manage the keys to her crypto fortune?
The crypto part of this, you know, public keys and private keys and interactions with the blockchain, like no consumer should ever have to see any of that. Like when you use Circle Pay and you are like sending and receiving money, you don't have to know anything about that. Just like grandma doesn't need to know she's using, you know, SSL and HTTP when she buys a book on Amazon. Or when you, you know, send an email to a friend, you don't know you're using SMTP and IMAP or whatever. You know, protocols and formats and the underlying security mechanisms, like those, no one should ever have to know anything about that. That's interesting for us as techies. It's interesting in terms of how the infrastructure works, but it's not interesting for a mainstream consumer.
I guess then let me ask you this, because I was going to ask you this anyway, just out of curiosity, not specifically about this, but I'm always curious how people see just management of, you know, computer security, identity, authentication, all these kind of things that seem like, I don't know, they really worry me about where we're heading.
Yeah.
And so I guess the solution you have right now is the relationship with, say, a Circle Pay and you guys making sure you know who we are, basically, and that's our security.
Well, there's obviously there's anti-fraud and identity and reputation and all these. And actually, Center has a framework for service providers that can provide services to nodes that implement Center. So, for example, if you're a service provider that can do, say, identity verification, or can do various forms of authentication, or can you know check for, you know, criminal activity or any form of identity or risk or other service, those third party, you know, companies or developers can build services that hook into Center, and then nodes that implement it can use those services. So there's a whole way that the ecosystem that's involved in security, identity, compliance, risk management, anti-fraud can plug into this. And there's an incentive for them to do that as well, because the way that those service providers are compensated is using SEND, which is the native token that is used in Center. Those are mechanisms that are there. But I mean, the bigger issue is, you know, identity is broken on the internet, and blockchain tech is a really interesting technical pattern that can be applied to address, you know, self-sovereign identity and identity security in general. And there are a lot of really interesting projects out there working on that. So I'm actually optimistic that crypto and blockchain tech is gonna you know, make major improvements in secure identity. If money was a missing layer of the internet, you know, identity is a missing layer of the internet, and both are, I think, really proactively being worked on, and blockchain tech is critical to both.
Unfortunately, the internet seems like it's enabled all of our identities to get stolen too. I hope it can be solved before everyone can basically almost prove to anyone that they're someone else. But Center doesn't really have a way, or does it, that someone, maybe if I fired up some kind of a wallet without any, you know, KYC identification to me, could I still somehow work with Center, or is it just not really built for that?
Yeah, no, technically, you know, a node would be able to be used in that way. I think that it's been designed so that there's a system of kind of trust and reputation. And so nodes can decide to trust other nodes based on assertions about essentially the level of compliance they have. So as Circle Pay, for example, might, you know, require that nodes that interact with it have a certain level of you know, verified compliance, whereas other nodes, you know, may not. We don't solve the issue of, you know, if you're a business that's using this technology, you need to make sure you're following all the laws of and regulations that exist in that jurisdiction. We don't, you know, obviously we're trying to build a system that can work with those constructs really effectively, and can kind of scale up and down in terms of trust and reputation based on that.
Wow. So I heard you say something about a token. Is that like a token, like token sale token, or is this just a native token that has anything you want to talk about that, or not really?
Yeah. So if you read the Center paper, the Center itself is just a recursive acronym. It stands for Cent Routing Exchange. And, Cent is the native token of Center, and a cent is required to be supported by all the nodes on the network. And so, for example, if I'm a digital wallet, say in Norway, and I have, you know, issued a crypto token for Kroner that I'm using with Center for customers, and I want to say send that Kroner token to a digital wallet that is, say, in India that supports Ruby. They may not each be liquid in Kroner and Ruby respectively, but they're required to be liquid in Cent. And so they can kind of cross currencies through Cent. So Cent becomes a kind of a settlement currency for these cross currency transactions. And it's also a token that is used for nodes that want to consume these third party services. And, you know, there can be third-party identity services, risk management services, FX liquidity services. So the way that those services are consumed is using Cent as well. So there's this kind of core token that's part of the protocol and the network scheme and how it works, with a very specific focus on enabling these sort of seamless cross-currency transactions. And that's really the central role of the Cent.
Gotcha. Well, I could keep asking you questions forever, but I know you got to go. Are there any websites or social media accounts you want to direct people to?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, circle.com. You can check out our core consumer app, and circletrading.com if you want to do large amounts of crypto trading, and center.io, which we've just launched, which, you know, gives you an overview of that project.
Great. Well, I really appreciate your time, Jeremy, and have a great day.
Thanks a lot. Bitcoin.
And just to clarify, the new Center Project's web address is centre.io. The American spelling of Center won't do. That was pretty cool having Jeremy Allaire as the guest for my 50th episode.
When I started the Bitcoin game 3 years ago, there were only a handful of podcasts I thought were really good in the space, so I was really excited to add content. But nowadays, there's really too much good content to even take it all in. Which brings me to the question, is the Bitcoin game still a relevant source of content? I'm looking for genuine feedback, so please let me know on Twitter at TheBTCGame or on this show notes page at TheBitcoinGame.com. See you next time. If not here, then on the blockchain.